This episode is brought to you by Not Alone Co. It has been such a pleasure for us at Not Alone Co. to create our little Not Alone community. We want to be able to utilize the messaging on our apparel in order to help facilitate tough and meaningful conversations with your loved ones. Community, conversation, and vulnerability. This is a journey, and mental health isn't a battle to be won. We at Not Alone Co. are here to remind you that you are never alone, and it's okay to not be okay. Use code NAC10 at checkout for 10% off your order, which helps us donate portions of the proceeds to various mental health charities and foundations. That's code NAC10 at checkout. We love you, and you're not alone.
All right, what's up, everybody? We start our show with some sort of brain buster question or discussion topic, and we're going favorite sports logo. It's a tough one. Ty, I don't want to put you on the spot, but hit me with your favorite sports logo.
I wish I was wearing I'm wearing the Syracuse Orangemen basketball shirt, and I wish it was like a cool logo, because then that would have been just like perfect for the show.
College logo could be another conversation too.
Good point.
Let's start with professional sports.
Dear Lord. Okay, I'm so biased because like the Pens, like I think the old Pens logo, yeah. Like I don't know, like it's funny because I was sifting through my t-shirts this morning and I almost put this Pittsburgh Penguins shirt on and it would have been the perfect moment, but it's not. So anyways, I think the Kachina Arizona logo is elite.
Go by sport. Okay. So we're hockey right now, Pens, that is that one's money. I just think, was it Snoop who was wearing the Pens jersey? That's what I think of right away.
I think that, did you see the new Tampa Bay Devil Rays? Like how they're bringing back the old Rays logo with like the purple.
No, I didn't see that.
Phenomenal. Just chef's kiss. do you have a baseball one?
Baseball one. I feel like I'm like kind of weirdly, like I'm associating it with like pop culture sort of thing.
Yeah.
LA Dodgers.
Ooh,
I mean, anything in LA, I feel like Lakers, Dodgers, Kings, like baseball. I mean, the Yankees, it's hard to like, I'm saying my favorite one though, like my dad, I grew up, my dad was an Oakland Raiders fan. And it was just like, I think of like their fans back, like, you know, classic Oakland Raiders fans were just nuts. And then like NWA, like, they kind of like the black and silver. Like, I like that. I like that vibe. That one stuck out to me when I was thinking of it.
That is a clean logo. Basketball. I think Old Nuggets is not a bad looking logo. I think the Celtics is for sure probably number one or two for me. I think the old Raptors, like Vince Carter, Raptor era.
The pinstripe jersey.
Dope. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeez. You know what? Football might be tough. Football, actually, I will say football has got a decent lineup of.
It's hard to think of them all, too, when you don't have them in front of you.
Oh, don't.
Miami Dolphins, like old school Dolphins.
I got the score app open right now and I'm researching.
You're looking.
I think even like. The Dolphins is a good logo. I think the Bengals, just like the simple B with the bangle stripes through. I don't know, man. It's that's tough. And like the
gives our listeners something to think about.
Yeah, because then you can also attribute it to the jersey and like how they actually like utilize the logo. Because like you could go back to those old Suns jerseys that like Charles Barkley and Steve Nash wore.
Steve Nash, one of my favorite all-time athletes.
But anyway, somebody who's probably dealt with a lot of logos, a lot of people, and a lot of sports figures in his life is our next guest, Michael Landsberg. For many Canadian listeners, this will be an instant off the record with Michael Landsberg. He had the amount of guests that he was listing off that he had the pleasure of joining him on his show is just Spike Lee, Donald Trump, Vince McMahon, just name after name. But on the other side of the coin, I mean, Michael Landsberg has done a lot in the mental health space and is also just a really good human being and is somebody that you can just tell it's so natural to just shoot the shit with him because he loves He loves challenging people, but he also loves learning and listening and trying to figure out, you know, how other people think and how other people's perspective. And I completely forgot, but this episode is powered by Torch Pro, and I am your co-host, Tyler Smith. And this coming from what time is it? Almost 6 o'clock Switzerland time. Riley Shan.
Dinner time.
Riles, what'd you think?
No, it was awesome. I mean, another voice that I've grown up on, listening to him on SportsCenter. I think the 5,000 episodes of SportsCenter too, that was mind-blowing. And then obviously Off the Record and different things too. I think he was involved with a couple Olympics too. So it was just really cool talking with him and listening to his stories, and then just listening to his like-mindedness and his approach to mental health. And I think it's really refreshing talking to someone like this. And it was just overall a great episode. I thought you can tell that he's spent a life of talking, and that's what he's done with his life. So he is very skilled at it and very entertaining, and just all in all, a great episode.
And as always, the Speak Your Mind team, our girl Hannah, is ripping the social media. Go check it out. Have some fun with it. Let us know what makes, you know, let us know what you want. Let us know what you don't like, you know, all that jazz. And please, by all means, always vote for me on New Tune Tuesday. But other than that, we hope you have an excellent day. We hope you speak your mind, and we hope you enjoy this episode, and we love you. How are you? Like, what's been going on lately? Obviously, we're getting into spring, so it's nice to see the sun a little bit out west, at least. But yeah, how are things?
Yeah, we don't cherish the sun and the warmth as much in Toronto as you might out west, right? Because your winter is rougher, right? But even here, I think it does play a little bit. It does have a little bit to do with my attitude on life, and that when you go outside and it's like, especially coming out of winter, you know, like 10 degrees coming out of winter feels like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. But if it was 10 degrees in the summer, you would go, well, this really sucks. And I'm going to bring this to mental health because there's an analogy. When you have had a bad time in your life, and in my case, it's been severe depression. And in my case, I had that 5 times. And each time I went off medication, I relapsed. But when you have been like a 1 on a scale of 1 to 10, and all of a sudden you're a 4, it feels like a 9. Yeah. It feels like, oh my God, like, yeah, I don't care that I'm not perfect. I don't even care that I'm pretty good. I feel this little bit of improvement, and it ignites something in you to want more improvement. So that was kind of a weird way to answer a question. Hey, Michael, how you doing? And the answer was what you just heard.
So obviously been in Toronto for a long time then, right? You obviously enjoy it. You ever get an urge to get out of the city or?
You know, because of the industry I worked in, because TSN was here and because, you know, this is the place in broadcasting that you generally broadcast nationally from. I was born in Toronto, came from a really close family. I followed all kinds of people that I knew, including my brother, who was 4 years older, to go to University of Toronto. And they all went on to do things that were university driven. And I was lost, man. Like for me, it was like, what am I doing here? But I didn't know anything else. And when I found this industry that I felt was kind of, I could make mine, that I could feel comfortable there, that I could work hard and try to excel at something, everything I did kept me in Toronto. And really the only job I've ever had has been at TSN, which was in Toronto. And I married a woman from Toronto, and the idea of bringing our kids up with their grandparents around, I thought was really appealing. So, I've been here, not very adventurous, but I've been here all my life.
All right. So 5,000 shows, 37 years, like I took television broadcasting actually, and I have a major amount of respect for, you know, what you did, because you said it perfectly. You were allowed to be you, and you were allowed to, you know, you were allowed to speak your values in a sports world. And I think that's an important thing. So this is going to be a pretty, you know, weird question, but like, what sticks out, you know, 5,000 shows, 37 years, and obviously we want to get into, I guess, your relationship with sports now, but like, that was you. You were, you know, off the record, Michael Landsberg. Like, what sticks out to you over that span of your life?
You know, I think what sticks out most of all was that I remain true to, I mean, there's shows that sticked out. Like, Off the Record was this amazing job where I got to meet like everyone. It's amazing how if I said, name a couple of names of famous people that there's a chance, like don't mention the Pope, but just think of a couple people and say, oh, this person, I bet you I either met them or I have a connection to them through somebody else. So that was a joy for me. But I think really, the first job I ever had was at an all-news radio station in Toronto. And I remember writing script for the next newscast that I was going to be doing, which was weird because I was doing news and it was like, oh my God, I don't know anything about news then. But I kind of made a commitment to myself that everything I did would be my way, meaning I wouldn't just write the predictable. Hey, the Toronto Maple Leafs, Montreal Canadiens last night. Wow, the Habs owned the Canadiens, but didn't you love the fact they put in their backup goaltender? Like that would be just predictable. That would be how everybody else might say it. So I think to the last thing that I've done, I've kind of done it my way, which means sometimes in my mind, it was good. And sometimes in my mind, after I did it my way, it was really shitty. So, but there's still something, there was always something honest about that.
Do you have, through that whole span with, I mean, specifically with Off the Record, do you have episodes that stick out in your mind? Or like, I know when you're in the sports world, like, I feel like you almost become numb to like fandom or getting too attached to anything. But like, was there a moment where you had like, wow, this is a time that I really enjoy and that I'm going to really remember for the rest of my life?
Yeah, you know, I was in Windsor last week to give a mental health speech. And for some reason, I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, it's because the Detroit Red Wings are across the river. I was trying to remember why. But at least, I don't know, five people asked me, hey. And by the third person, I knew what they were going to say as they said, hey. What was that like with, and we did a show with Claude Lemieux and Darren McCarty, and they had this like massive anger issue on the ice, right? Like Chris Draper got hit from behind by Claude Lemieux and broke his face up. Oh, it was, I mean, like it was classic hockey rivalry, right? You know, like the only thing that's good when two guys like each other is when they hate each other. And this was the classic of that. So my answer was, well, it was so cool because Claude Lemieux, I had got to know a little bit because he'd done the show. And he's one of those guys you go, wow, that guy's a great guy. You know, he's Claude Lemieux. He's supposed to be a little shit, but he was a great guy. And because he'd done the show a few times, I said to him, would you do a show with Darren McCarty if we could get him to come on? And he goes, yeah, I'd love to. I got no anger at Darren McCarty. So he shows up. We're taping, say, at 3 o'clock for a 6 o'clock show, Eastern time. And he shows up at the appropriate time. And him and I are waiting for Darren McCarty. We wait 90 minutes for him, sitting in the studio waiting for him. And McCarty walks in and he's pissed. You can see from his body language that he has not forgiven Claude Lemieux. So he sits down and we start the show. And, you know, McCarty's got this like real chip on his shoulder. And as the show goes on, you don't see the chip leaving. But you kind of realize when we're like 15 minutes into the show, wow, he's not mad anymore. And by the end of the show, they were making, you know, arrangements to go and have a conversation together. And it really was an example in life of if you get two people together to hate each other, but they're not 100% sure if they should still hate each other because the thing they hated about is in the past, can really like work. So I love shows like that. I love shows when I talked to people that I thought were smarter than me because that meant I could fight my hardest in an argument, that I could try to push them into a corner and see if I could get more truth out of them. But you can't do that with someone who you think, wow, you know, I'm just going to look like a bully. I remember early on and Off the Record, the producer in my ear saying, don't be a bully. No one likes a bully. So, you know, like Brian Burke, until he wasn't, was a great guy for that. He was great because he's super smart. And the challenge of challenging someone on their life, like think about it. Okay, I'll use a better example because it's more sort of outside my life. Vince McMahon. when you're interviewing Vince McMahon and you're trying to push him to clarify something, or if you think that he's not telling the truth, then you got to push. But now you're debating his world, right? So now I'm debating wrestling, which is what he knows, what he lives in, and I'm only a visitor for the day to it. So that to me was the fun of the job, was developing the confidence to be able to challenge someone on their own lives in their world when I was just a visitor.
Oh God, I could imagine some, that's got to require some good skill there. Just bringing back to the McCarty, Claude Lemieux, like I remember playing in Detroit, and every time we put that, or the media team put that video up in the arena, it didn't matter. Like that's how many, what year was that? 94? Early mid 90s, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's 2015 at the time, and they're still, the crowd would just roar at that moment every game.
But it was really like, cool. You know, you hear the other perspective, right? You know, you hear, I mean, that role existed in hockey, the, you know, either the enforcer or the shithead, right? Who, that's what he was there for. Like Claude Lemieux had more talent, obviously, than a lot of guys who played that position or did that job. But still, he knew that, I mean, he wouldn't have been, he won the Conn Smythe a couple of times, at least. He would not have won the Conn Smythe if he didn't play like that, right? He wasn't that good a player that he could have helped a team to Stanley Cups based on his hockey skill. So that position existed, and guys knew that. And sometimes, like, the best talkers I ever met as a group were the enforcers. Like, unbelievable. Like, I hated Cam Jansen because he hit Thomas Cabrera from behind. Or, no, he hit him really, really late. And I'm a Leaf fan, right? I fucking hated him. And then when the pandemic started, our charity started to do a show called Isolation Nation, where it was basically a talk show. And the idea was to talk to people about mental health and about how they were coping with being isolated because of the pandemic. And we had Cam Jansen on. And I thought, I love this guy. This guy is so smart. This guy is so self-aware. That's the thing. It's not like, oh, yeah, well, Cabrera deserved it. He knew his job was to go out there and whatever it took to help New Jersey win that game. And if that meant that Thomas Cabrera was going to get hit by him late, then that was okay. I mean, Bob Probert. Bob Probert was – my daughter was in Ryerson at Radio and Television when Bob Probert was – this was after his career. He was playing in a charity game in, I don't remember where it was. Maybe it may have been Calgary, called the Juno Cup. So there were musicians on one side and there were ex-hockey players on the other side, or ex-NHLers on the other side. And Bob Probert was there. My daughter was doing a documentary for school about, you know, the challenge of retirement for hockey players. So I had interviewed Bob Probert a few times on Off the Record, and he was so gentle and so lovely. So I said to him, hey, Bob, could you do me a favor? My daughter's doing a project and she would like to interview you. He said, sure, absolutely. And then I said, you know, like, she's never done this before. He goes, don't worry, I got her. So we go in the locker room and I'm holding the camera, and Casey goes up to Bob Probert, and Casey was probably 19 at the time. She probably looked like she was 12. And I'm thinking, oh my God, like, this is the big time. Like, Bob Probert, he's scary. And he goes, Case, you know, I'm looking forward to you talking to me. I think he called her Case, which was like, made her relax even more. He said, you don't worry about a thing. You ask me a question and we'll have a great time. And I thought, wow, Bob Probert. You know, just the most gentle soul you could imagine. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, that's cool.
We've been fortunate to be able to have a couple people in the media world on, you know, Emily Kaplan, Chris Johnston, some people that are really just genuine about their interview process. And I think that is like something that I find so valuable, especially when you are going to be bringing in McCarty and Lemieux and creating, you know, not a hostile environment, but their past is hostile. Where did that, I guess, you know, stem from for you, of being able to make sure that you're creating this space that, yes, there could be some, I'm going to challenge you and this could get a little, you know, but where did that, I guess, begin or start for you?
You know, I think the first interview I did, when I was in school, I worked at, I told you, talk radio. And for a year afterwards, I worked at a music station where they let me do sports. which was not part of sort of their game plan, but they knew that, you know, like I was really passionate about it and they let me do it. And I started doing interviews and I thought, wow, you know, I've never done an interview before, right? This is really cool. You know, I get to ask anything I want. And I think I realized right away that the key to doing an interview is listen to what they're saying, because very often they'll give you the tip off on the best question by how they're answering another question. And if you're not really paying attention, if you're tied down to looking down to what's my next question, then you're going to miss it. So really a good interview, if you wanted to do it this way, would be one question. You ask one question and then it's a conversation. And it's not like you search for things in a conversation to ask, you just talk. So that kind of reaction is really good. But for me, I think the key was research and making sure. Confidence comes from knowing that you know the subject. So, you know, you're talking to Brian Burke about Brian Burke in trades he'd made and his belief in the importance of fighting or whatever, and his career and his life and all of these things. If you learn them, then you can just look him in the eyes and think, okay, well, you know, I got this. But if not, you know, like you're really afraid to take it to different areas because you know you don't know much about it. So I think really working hard beforehand makes it a lot easier to work during the interview. And especially on Off the Record, I was lucky that we had a crew and we always had a couple of interns. And I would say to people, this would be the procedure. Okay, well, you know, I'm talking to whether it was a show with a panel or let's say, I'm just trying to think of a guest who I wouldn't have known that much about, but you guys could throw out a name. But I would ask everyone, I'd say, okay, by 3 o'clock this afternoon, send me 10 questions that you would ask them based on research. So now, like there was probably 4 or 5 people that were doing that. So now I'd have 50 questions from different people and I would look through them and go, oh, okay, well, that's really clear that there's something great to ask about that. So I think it's all about research. It's all about planning and it's all about getting good at research too and understanding. Like I always, my key was always, if I was doing a straight interview, was to ask a question off the top. The first question I asked that would have the guest going, wow, you know, how'd you know that? Or, yeah. Well, that's an interesting place to dive into because that makes them feel, when you do an interview with someone and they've taken the time to do it, the best way to say thank you to them and to compliment them is to learn stuff about them, to prepare and to research. That's like the ultimate compliment.
You can tie that into mental health too, right? Like waking up each morning when you know you're prepared to get at your day or whatever, it makes your days easier, whether things not hanging over your head, you have like stuff you haven't paid or people you haven't paid back, or you have all these duties that you realize that you're missing out on. And even like sports too, like if you're not training, if you're not eating right, and then all of a sudden you got to jump into training camp, it makes things that much harder. So
I don't know if you saw it, my daughter came up and gave me a cup of coffee. That's the Bob Probert.
I love that.
And just by the way, I spilled about, I don't know, a couple of ounces on my leg. It's a lot, man. So I'm playing through pain here. That's what you got to do.
What kind of coffee?
I love strong coffee. It's my thing. So I boil water and I use a French press and nice. I even use Starbucks coffee. And I just, coffee is like my thing. I don't drink a ton of it, but just first sip in the morning. I call it the basic joy test. Watch the great segue here to mental health. The great, the basic joy test is this, especially talking about depression, but it works for anxiety and other mental illnesses. The question is, how you doing? And I answer that question like in my own mind, or when I say to people, you know, are you okay? Because you don't seem okay. And they'll say, well, you know, I'm not sure, right? Because mental illness doesn't define itself like a rash. You look at a rash and you go, I have a rash. But mental illness, you can't look at it. You can't see it. You can't biopsy it. You can't do a blood test or an X-ray or an MRI. So how do we gauge it? And my answer to people very often is, think about something that brings you basic joy. Like not, oh my gosh, you know, like my team won the Stanley Cup, or I just got a great job, or like that doesn't happen very often, or I just got married or had a kid. Those are things that don't happen often, but little like basic joy. For me, basic joy comes from that first sip of a cup of coffee in the morning where I go, yeah, I like that. It's not like I'm going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, that coffee's so great. It's just like basic joy, which makes our day worthwhile. And the question then becomes, do you still feel the basic joy from that thing that always brought you joy? And for me, I know when I have had severe depression for sure, but even just sort of moderate depression, I lose the ability to experience joy. So I would answer that question at a bad time in my life. I would say, no, not really. You know, like, and it's important to frame it where you have something to judge it. Someone will say, do you think I should see a doctor? And I'll say, okay, well, 2 years ago, what was something that brought you joy? Oh, it was whatever. Take my dog for a walk. Now when you take your dog for a walk, how do you feel? And really think about it. Like, not, you know, do you do it, but do you feel the joy that comes from something like that? Because that's what depression robs us of whatever it takes to feel that joy. It's like it's gone. And when people say things like, oh, you know what, you just try harder, or, you know, just get out and take a nice walk. I kind of have this thing, which is fuck the walk. The walk represents all the ideas that people have for those of us who battle depression, right? You know, like, do something fun, or appreciate the good things in your life, or, you know, why don't you do this? Or why don't you go out for a nice meal? It's like, well, okay, that's great. Like, a walk is fine, but it's not a cure for mental illness. So basic joy tends to be a really good way to give yourself a frame of reference.
I like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective, and I definitely resonate with that. And now that kind of leads me to, obviously, off the record, TSN, those years brought you a lot of joy. When you started losing that joy, and when you knew that you had a decision to make, how did you get through that? And how did you, you know, how did you frame your mind now to being, okay, I don't have the joy I once had for this. Like, I need to do something for me. Can you talk us through that, a little bit about that process?
I can. Well, I can basically talk you a little bit through everything, because when I feel good, it's like, you can't shut me up. Try. Okay, try to shut me up. But, you know, I think that's a great question. I think that I think this is really good, because I feel like I'm talking to two guys who understand it. And it's not that often that I sit on this side of, you know, the equation. I'm answering questions, which is kind of fun. But, you know, that's a great question, because especially something like depression can happen. I mean, you had obviously a profoundly horrible depression-causing incident in your life, right? But I didn't have that. So what it tends to be for me, and many people, is this tiny, tiny change that happens in us that's so small we don't notice it, right? It's like a tiny tap on the arm that we don't feel, but if you tap on the arm 1,000, a million times, eventually it'll start to hurt. It's like, you know, you don't notice yourself, for instance, gaining weight, right? During the pandemic, a lot of people gained weight, you know, and they didn't notice it. It's like, you know, you might gain, you know, 1/100 of a pound or a kilogram a day. So you don't feel that until you go to put on your pants and you go, holy shit, you know, like, I gained a lot of weight. You need something to tip you off sometime that you've changed. And for me, that was actually getting asked by the producer of the show to go screen a movie, because the guest, Vin Diesel, how cool is that name drop, is on the show the next day. And I said to him, Bob, you know, I can't go. I'm sorry. And he said, oh, okay, whatever. And that was my job to go. But when I hung up the phone, I thought, wow, that's like, weird that I would say no. And then I started to think about why I said no, and all the things that I'd said no over in the past couple of months, past 6 months, or maybe 8 months even. Then I started to think about how I'd really retreated, how I was looking for opportunities to be alone, not with people, which goes totally against my my natural instinct. And I just thought, it hit me after forensically evaluating my own life, it hit me, oh my God, like, there's something really wrong with me. And the worst thing about it was that I realized I changed. I thought to myself, I have become another person. I hate this person. How did this happen? And I have to get me back. And that's the day that I went to the doctor and started the process of getting me back. And that happened to me 5 different times, where I was totally lost in this hole of depression, where I would look up from the hole, metaphorically, obviously, and think to myself, I can't even see the top. I can't see a way out. It was just, it was like I had, my body had been taken over by this awful plague that I had no idea. I don't know. Now, the two of you, your story, have you both or one of you or neither of you suffered from severe depression? Or when I say severe, I mean, we don't know always if it is, but if you go, well, this really sucks, that would be, you know, pretty severe depression.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting, especially with grief. I think there's always kind of those moments where not this really sucks, but at the end of the day, this sucks, you know, like the 5-year anniversary, this sucks. But do I guess I haven't been, you know, clinically diagnosed on depression or anxiety. So, yeah.
I guess more similarly to you, like I have been, I've been on medication. I'm not on medication right now, but I spent a good portion of my career, 5 years, 6 years, with an SSRI and Xanax and things like that. But yeah, it was always just like, for me, I felt like it was always just like, I'm in a position that I've dreamed of since I was a little kid. And why am I still not feeling the contentment that I feel like I should be based off how everyone else perceives my life? So that's kind of always been a question, and something that I battle with. So
that's depression, what you just described. Thanks for that. It's, you know, I think the most powerful thing that you can do with something like depression is to being specific and recalling moments, because that's what people relate to. Like, you know, if you Google symptoms of depression, you'll get, you know, like, you know, a billion hits in or a billion websites in like a half a second. And they all kind of have the same things, you know, loss of appetite, inability to sleep at night, tired during the day, like things that are symptoms. But I don't think people relate to that. But if you start a sentence with, you know, when I realized that there was something wrong with me was when I stepped on the ice at the Air Canada Center, I'm making this up. And, you know, like it was my lifelong dream to step on the ice at the Air. Oh, wait, I'm living my life now through you. My lifelong dream. But if you say, and you know, I'm stepping on the ice and all the energy is, and I just don't feel any joy. That's the kind of thing that people relate to, because that's what they have gone through in a different context. And I think all of us experience some things in common when it comes to an illness like anxiety or an illness like depression. One of them is the loss of the ability to experience joy. How about self-esteem? Did you feel like your self-esteem was less when you were battling, you know, the real bad depression?
Yeah, definitely. Like I'm just a very, like, I'm a person who really seeks social connection. And like, I think Ty is similar too in this way. Like we just value like relationships and value fitting in, and we want other people to fit in and we want to fit in. And I guess I'm speaking for myself, but saying we, sorry, Ty. So self-esteem, definitely like I always had hockey to lean on, and that's where I kind of always fit in. And people, I guess, would want to be around me because of maybe the success that I had playing hockey. But then I struggled definitely like overthinking the way I'm perceived and overthinking like if I'm letting my teammates down by my poor play, or if I'm letting, you know. And then I had these instances where I did let people down, like I said, with these drinking related offenses where I was getting arrested and things like that. And I think all of that just kind of just kept falling on me. And then it created this, these amplified feelings. So, that's where I struggled with that.
You know who experiences that? Everybody who experiences mental illness like that. All of us. I mean, we all live different lives, right? I mean, we all can't relate to, we all haven't gone through, you know, playing professional hockey at the highest level and feeling like, oh, you know, I've let people down. Not all of us go, most of us don't, but all of us have things in our life. Like for me, it was always looking into the camera. I'm looking into the camera right now. And I feel like, you know what? And this isn't an ego thing at all, but in the context of my own life, I feel like, hey, you know, I own this, right? I'm talking about something I know. I'm a professional talker. Like, okay, let's do this. But when I'm not feeling myself, even in a small way, I look into the camera and think, God, they're thinking to themselves, well, this sucks, or this is a disappointment, or wow, you know, I thought he'd offer more. And that comes out most profoundly for me when I give a live talk in front of a live audience. When I feel good, it's like, like when someone's introducing me, I'll be like up there standing beside them because I want to do it, right? You know, like I know I got something important to say and I look forward to sharing it. But on a bad day, I'll be thinking to myself, God, why did I say yes to this? Oh my God, I'm going to get up there and these people are just going to go, wow, that was a disappointment. And that's true whether whatever you do in your life. It's like depression finds this thing to freak us out. This like voice tells us, you're no good, you're going to suck, these people will be disappointed. Whatever it is that we fear, the depression tells us that our fears are real. And I think that just talking about it and other people hearing that you have experienced the same thing is really important.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I think I saw you had a Bud Light the other day, and I think we'll have to have a couple Bud Lights because I definitely I relate to that a lot. I especially in the public speaking space, you know, which is a space I didn't ever really imagine getting into. But it's the exact same thing. Like my girlfriend will text me and be like, how was the speech? And sometimes it's like, yeah, you know, pretty good. Like I missed a couple points that I wanted to talk about, this and that. And then other times it's like, holy shit, that felt so good. You know, like that was like, I felt good. It felt natural. I was making people laugh, like this and that. So it is interesting how it just, how your mind can just trick you to be like, okay, that wasn't your best, you know, that even though you went out there and put yourself out there and became vulnerable and talked about your story and hopefully impacted others, that wasn't your best, you know? So just, you know, move on to the next one.
That was exactly how I feel, what you just described. So yeah. I'll call my wife afterwards and she'll say, how was it? And almost always say, not really for me to say, right? You know, but I know, just like, you know, if the audience, you know, is buying it. And to me, the key for me is exactly what you just said, is to bring a range of emotions, have them laugh, but also have them emotionally engaged. On days when I'm not feeling it, I could say to Karen, oh my God, that sucked. Oh God, it was terrible. And yet you could go out to the audience and say to people, if they would be honest with you, they might say, well, I thought it was pretty good. You know, like people don't necessarily monitor every syllable that comes out of your mouth the way you monitor every syllable. And the Bud Light thing, I shot those videos and tweeted out yesterday because I'm a big believer in equal rights for everyone. And I thought, oh my God, people want to boycott Bud Light and Nike because they put a trans person on their advertising. And so I thought, okay, well, if they want to make a statement by boycotting Bud Light, I'm going to make a statement by buying Bud Light. And it wasn't bad, actually. It wasn't bad.
I love that. I think we'll have to definitely have a couple Bud Lights. But I want to definitely go back to, because you said it perfectly, like when you make that decision, and especially like when you aren't feeling it and when you're starting to lose that joy, that is you. And when you make that decision to go to the doctor, that's you. But on the other side of the coin, there is so much talk about support system, and support systems are so valuable. And even, you know, the fact that you can call your wife after a speaking engagement, that's valuable. And that's very important. I want to ask, because when you made that decision and when you started opening up about your mental health, let's be honest, you were probably one of the first real advocates and first real people that actually really did that. What was that response like, especially in a sports world? Because I know, like, I've been fortunate to now look at Simone Biles and Jonathan Drouin and Carey Price and be like, well, shit, you know, like, these guys are doing it, these people are doing it, like, I can do it too. But at that time, I don't think there was a lot of people that you could look up to and be like, oh shit, you know, that person who I look up to is doing it and taking care of themselves too. So what was that response?
It's a really well-phrased question. I think that for me, it was really easy because I never cared what people thought. Like, I think part of that is that I was brought up in a great house where my parents adored me. So I always felt like, you know, I never really cared as much as other kids what people thought of them. But broadcasting gave me a confidence, right? Broadcasting, gave me a place where I could be myself. And I became this broadcaster, even on, in the early days of my career, but especially on Off the Record, that people hated and that people liked, right? Hey, Landsberg, you're a fucking idiot. And hey, Landsberg, I really like the show. And I became really actually good with that. Like I would look forward to people, you know, saying the negative because it's more interesting to, you know, than someone saying, oh, watch your show. It's so awesome. So I think I got really thick skin because of that. And because of everything about me, when in 2009, that was kind of the first time I ever spoke about mental illness. It was a year after this, 11-24-08-YUL-MH-521-0400. I had that tattooed on my arm this past summer, November 24th, 2008, YUL, Montreal, airport code. MH-521, Marriott Hotel Room 521-0400, 4 a.m. in the morning. We were shooting off the record at the Grey Cup. I had been severely depressed for a year. I kept refusing to go back because I didn't want to go back on medication. Who wants to be on meds? And I kept fooling myself. And then, you know, I started using benzos. You mentioned Xanax. Well, I was using Ativan, and it was you know, you take 0.5 milligrams. That's the starting dose. And then after 3 weeks, you go, it's not working anymore. So you start taking one, and then you start taking 1.5, and then you start taking 2. And before you know it, you go, I'm fucked. So I had this awful year. And when I was in Montreal shooting at the Grey Cup, I sat on the edge of my bed and I thought, wow, this is why people take their own lives. And it wasn't that I didn't love my wife, and it wasn't that I didn't love my kids, and it wasn't that I didn't like my job, and it wasn't that I had a gambling debt that I wanted to run from. It had nothing to do with any of that. It was just there was something really, really, really painful that was going on in my life. And that's a pain you can't explain to people. You know, like mental health pain, you can't explain it. You can't tell people what it feels like. So, like for me, it was, wow, I'm sitting on the bed and going, this is why people take their lives. Cause I was just so afraid of having to battle through another day of pain. I just like, if you don't have hope, and I did because I'd been through it before and the right medication had made a difference to me. But if I would have been hopeless at that point, you know, I wouldn't have taken my life then. But eventually I would have got to the point where it's like, I can't stand this pain. Imagine if I flew to Switzerland, hacked off your arm, it sewed it up, but the pain that you felt from having your arm hacked off was never going to go away. So you weren't going to bleed to death, but it was never going to go away. Like how long until you would say, oh my God, like, you know, like there's no point in being alive. And that's kind of the way I looked at it. But in 2009, I was feeling better and I was interviewing Stéphane Richer, Montreal Canadian, and I had read that he battled depression in the 1990s. So I thought, oh, that'll be an interesting question. So I said, Stéphane, you've never met me before. This was before the show. You've never met me before. So you have no obligation, you know, please, you know, take a pass. But if it's okay, can I ask you about depression? Because I think people would like to know. And he said, it's very painful for me. And I said, okay, well, but if you'll talk about it, I'll talk about it. And he said, well, what would you talk about? And I told him my story. And he said, let's do it. We went on the air. We talked for 2 minutes tops. He talked a bit about his story. He said the most amazing metaphor for how bad is depression. Say to me, how bad is depression? One of you say it.
How bad is depression?
Nice little teamwork there. Yeah. He would say it's so bad that as a Canadian, a Montreal kid drafted by the Montreal Canadiens, rookie of the year in the NHL, last Montreal Canadian to score 50 goals, I win the Stanley Cup and nothing brought me joy. That was the first time I heard someone use that term, like no joy. And it just stuck with me. But he said, like, imagine I'm holding the Stanley Cup on the ice and all I want to do is go home and get in bed and get away from everything and everyone. And I thought, wow, you know, that's, you know, I don't have an example of, you know, wild success like winning the Stanley Cup. But I know for me, there's been things in my life exactly in my own, from my own perspective, like that. And yeah, I couldn't feel joy. So we talked for 2 minutes. He also said, you know, I won the Stanley Cup in New Jersey. And 5 days later, I tried to drive off the road and end my life. And I just thought, wow, this was cool. It's a good show. I didn't think that we changed anyone's life. And that wasn't my goal to change anyone's life because I didn't know that people needed to hear this kind of stuff. So I started getting emails from people, mostly men, and they all said basically the same thing. And like, I would read it and it would say, hey, Michael, watching you and Stéphane Richer yesterday talking about depression was the first time in my life I've seen two men talking about it. And the fact that you weren't ashamed or embarrassed and you didn't sound weak has got me telling you something I've never told another human being. I, too, suffer the same way. But I've never gone to a doctor because I've been too ashamed. But now I'm going to do it because I thought, wow, if they can do it, I can do it. And that changed my life, like 180 degrees. We're having this conversation at, you know, in Toronto at 10 a.m. in the morning. And I'm talking about mental health with two guys that obviously I've never met before. And we would not be having this conversation if Stefan Richer wouldn't have said, okay, let's talk about it.
It's crazy too, like when you're in the position, you almost like Richer, and even for yourself, like how your brain can keep fooling yourself to like keep pushing through, because it almost like manipulates your own self to thinking that you're doing all these things and all like, and so just keep doing it. Like, you're fine. Just keep doing it. You have all this stuff. Keep doing it. But then like for Richer to even say, like, just being blatant, like listing all these accomplishments, but I still don't feel any joy. Like, that's pretty admirable.
Yeah. It changed his life too. You know, like we've had a couple of, I mean, I don't see him much, but I hear hellos from him because he plays in alumni games. And, you know, like, he changed my life by saying, yeah, let's do this. And I changed his life only because I convinced him to talk about it. But I mean, this was really all about him. And I was just along for the ride to convince him to talk about it. But it's, you're 100% right. You know, the brain, because you can't define mental illness, right? In a way, you can't quantify it. As I said before, you know, you know, almost everything else. Oh, what's wrong with my knee? You know, my knee's not feeling good. So you go for an MRI and, you know, they tell you, okay, well, you know, unfortunately, you know, you have a torn ACL and, you know, we have to reconstruct it. Like, that's, it's not like, oh, you know, I was fooling myself into thinking I didn't have a problem. I mean, these are things that can be resolved definitively. But mental illness is all gray area, right? It's all about, you know, how you interpret your own experience in life. And if you are in denial because you don't want to be mentally ill, or if you're ashamed, I mean, no one wants to be, but if you're saying, well, no, I'm not, like, you're not saying it actively, but if you're going through your day going, okay, well, you know, that was normal, even though I didn't feel good. Like, we can lie to ourselves, we can fool ourselves, and we can wishful think ourselves into not being aware of it. Like, wishful thinking is when you go, no, I don't need to go to a doctor. You know, I don't have depression. I don't have to go on medication. I don't have to do analysis. I'm fine, because that's what we want ourselves to be. Mm-hmm. So I think, unlike almost any other illness, mental illness, you know, we need to have this conversation with people who can ask us questions like, hey, what brings you basic joy? And does it still bring you basic joy?
I think that this is a good lead into my next question, but I think you already answered it, even just with the basic joy test. Like, I mean, we ask a lot of our guests about this idea of like taking a step back from your sport or taking a break from your job, whatever it is. But like, how do you define that line where it's okay? Or like, unfortunately, there's probably people out there that are using mental health as like to their advantage, saying like, oh, I just don't feel like doing this, rather than maybe the healthy thing at that point is to push through, because at the other end, it could make you feel good. It could make you feel better that you accomplished something. So I'm just curious, like, your stance of like, how do you define that line between the push through versus using it as like the easy way out?
Right. Well, I think, you know, for me, I would say I never took the easier way out, mm-hmm. Because there's no easy way out of, you know, having a mental health struggle. But if you're saying, okay, well, I have a choice. I can go to work and host a show for that day and I'm going to feel like crap, or I can stay home and lie on the couch and watch TV all day and I'm going to feel like crap, but I won't feel the pressure of needing to appear to be okay. I never took that. I never missed a show, like not one. And unless you've been through it, you can't appreciate that. Like, you go, well, you weren't sick. Like, why would you? But, you know, for me, it didn't matter if I stayed home. That was like, there were two things. Number one, I didn't have the kind of job I felt like I could say, you know, okay, I'm, you know, I need to take off a week now and a week. And I, you know, like, I just didn't think that opportunity availed itself to me. But also, I knew that staying home and lying on the couch, even though it would be easier, wouldn't feel any better. Like, I couldn't get away from this thing. The only difference was that I wouldn't have felt the pressure on those days if I would have stayed home to be my best and then be disappointed that I wasn't my best. So I would go host a show. I'd be sitting watching the show unfold with a separate part of my brain, like where it's like you're watching yourself. And I'd be thinking, man, this is so lame. Oh, God, did you just ask that question, Michael? Did you just ask that question? That's a terrible question. Oh, my God, you just stumbled. You like I would be beating myself up as the show would be going on. And certainly I would like to have avoided that. But for the most part, it didn't really matter. I felt crappy wherever I was.
Right.
Everything that we've talked about kind of leads me to one major topic that has been a big piece of my life, connection. Connection for you for 37 years was, you know, connecting with these figures in the sports media, entrepreneurial world, and talking about their lives, talking about them, talking about this and that. Now you're public speaking, and now you're in this space where you're talking about you. But afterwards, you're connecting with people based on your story, which leads to them sharing about their own story. That is something that, you know, for me, it almost breaks my heart and then repairs it at the same time, because it's crazy to think that I'm connecting with an 85-year-old man who just lost his wife to cancer and who's telling me that grown men cry too. And it's just like, it's so interesting because it brings out so many emotions, but then again, it takes me back to, this is what it's all about, and this is what I love, and this is the connection that I need, and this is the connection that this old man who's lived a full life needs as well. So I just want to talk about connection for you and how your stance has, I mean, you've connected for so long, and I'm not saying your stance has completely changed, but I guess your perspective on connection.
Well, I love what you said though. It breaks my heart, but repairs my heart.
Yeah, I don't know what it means.
You know, but sometimes you don't have to know what it means. People in the audience would just go, "Wow, that sounds really smart," even if they don't think it through. But no, I know what it means.
Yeah. And,
I'm going to steal that. And, you know, next time I'm up on stage, I'm going to go, you know, because I think the one word that would apply to what you just said would be vulnerability. Showing your own vulnerability allows other people to show theirs.
Yeah.
You know, I tell this to people who are leaders in business in a company, where, you know, they're, CEO, and they want a more mentally healthy and mentally honest company. And I say, if you want people to be honest with you, be honest with them. And if you want them to show vulnerability, then show vulnerability to them and for them. And it's like, it's contagious, right? When you get up on stage and you share things that are really personal and really painful, especially, that opens the door for other people to do the same. It's like I've said this before, mental illness is not contagious. You can't catch depression. But the sharing of mental illness is very much contagious. And sometimes that's what people need. And so, yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about it this way, but my life changed from talking about other people's lives to using my own life to make a difference in other people's lives. And I kind of look at it this way. I remember I was giving a speech to the Mood Disorders Association of Ontario. Like, I mean, that would be one of like mega speeches in history. I mean, that's like being in front of United Nations. I'm kidding. But I thought, you know, like I learned something about myself. I said, you know, talking about mental health like I am right now, this is what I said when I was on stage, it's empowering for me because I get to use the worst thing in my life, which has been mental illness, as one of the best things in my life. I get to put purpose to my pain. I get to use my own poison, which would be depression, as someone else's medicine, which is exactly what you're doing, right? The worst thing in your life, you're using to make a difference in someone else's life. And that gives purpose to all the pain that you've been through. Not that you would say, oh, well, I'm glad it happened. Of course you're not, but it happened. You can't do anything about it. So what are you doing? You're taking that and you're using the depth that you can describe the pain that you have felt for other people's benefit, because they, in many cases, have felt similarly depth pain, but not, you know, they weren't in a bus crash, you know, the circumstances have been different and, you know, their lives didn't change necessarily, you know, in one moment like that. But everyone has things that have affected them at times, and you allow people to talk about them.
Yeah, it's so interesting because especially that's a big thing as well as comparing stories. And I think we're as humans, we're so quick to diminish our own story and also resort to comparison because we don't, you know, we never want to put ourselves on a pedestal and we never want to make it seem as though like our story overbears everybody else's. You know, it's just okay, that person's got it worse, that person's got it better. You know, I don't want to glorify what I'm going through, so I'm just going to kind of sit back. But it's so interesting because when that space is created, it's mind-blowing how many different types of people that have been through crazily different things in their lives just feel as though this is where I can just be me and this is where I can feel accepted and heard. And I think that's something that it's I don't know if you feel the same way, but it's craving. And I really, as much as I know that I still need to set boundaries and still have to have that balance in my life of it's something that I love speaking, but I love the connection afterwards. And I don't know if you feel the same way.
I always say, especially when I get hired to do a speech, because I don't charge for speeches when it's like, a charity or community. You know, I've had the chance to go to small communities and stand on stage and talk for, for as long as they want me to talk and to interact with people, and that's amazing. And I say small communities because, when you speak in Calgary or Edmonton or Vancouver or Toronto or any of the, cities above a certain size, they're kind of all the same, right? But when you speak in a place called Blythe, Ontario, where I spoke, or Exeter, Ontario, or like there's all these places I didn't even know they exist, and I've lived in Toronto all my life, Southern Ontario, like all of these places, oh my gosh. And I feel like I get a chance to connect with the entire community because there's only 4,000 people in the city and 1,000 people are there. And tragically, it almost always happens after a young hockey player takes his or her own life. Like, I can't tell you how many times that's happened where I've been asked to speak in a community because now they're so aware that there are real serious consequences to mental illness. So, just like you said, I'll get up on stage and I'll talk and I'll try to offer as much of me as I could possibly offer. And then when I'm finished, I tell people, look, I'm just going to stand here for a while. If you want to come up and talk, we'll talk. And if you want to talk alone, just tell me and I'll tell everyone else to move away or we'll walk away. And I've had the most profound and deep discussions of my life in exactly that setting, which is what you were talking about. But back to what you do, you can get in front of people, and I'm sure you think about this because you kind of said it, right? Like, you're worried that you've had this profound moment that is beyond imagine. It's unimaginably painful for people to, like, no one's going to look at what you've been through and not go, oh my God, that's like the worst thing that can happen in somebody's life was what you went through. So as from what you're saying, you're kind of aware of getting up there and it's almost like bragging. Oh my God, I've been through the worst. And you're worried that people won't be able to relate to it. But, it's like I study World War II. It's my hobby. And I PTSD is like this massive thing that really wasn't understood at that point. But what people felt was that they knew, like a generation later, every person that landed on Juno Beach on the 6th of June and fought their way for almost a year into Germany surviving, they were like mentally crushed and abused by the things that they saw and experienced. And most of them never spoke a day in their life about what they went through. And almost all of them ended up drinking. And my point is that PTSD can come from things other than fighting in a war and being shot at and seeing your buddies killed. PTSD can come from things other than what you went through. Because there are things that affect us so deeply, but they're not as blatant. Like when my daughter was 4, she had a serious eye condition, and at one time she was legally blind in both eyes. And I never recovered from that. Guys, I would go and do my job. I would go and host a show, and I was just obsessed with what happens if she can't see in either eye. And fortunately, she not the first part is unfortunately, but fortunately she has vision in one of her eyes, and she lost a vision in the other eye, which means you can live a normal life. Your vision is as good as your good eye. I lived and clung to that. But that had such a profound effect on me that I'm sure that my experience with depression, and especially depression, probably would have been a little bit less, or maybe not at all, if I would have gone to a psychologist and unloaded that. But I bury that. You know, I never allow myself to think back to what that was like. And I saw a picture because I had an aunt that died last week, and her family was showing all these pictures. And there was a shot of me holding Casey in my lap, and she was on prednisone at the time, cortisone. So her face was, you know, all. And honestly, it was like, please get this picture away from me. It just like I flashed back to this time. So good for you for using, you know, this unbelievably poignant moment in your life and accepting the fact that others would have poignant moments as well that maybe, you know, weren't, you know, as horrible as yours, but in their world, they were incredibly painful.
Yeah, we need to, I think Riley and I have had this conversation many times, especially with Joe Hawley, just about how we need to, in society, we need to make room for our small losses as well, and our small grievances, and our small triumphs as well. And I think, you know, that's definitely something that we've tried to help amplify. But yeah, Rouse, go ahead.
We can touch on sick, not weak.
I think the powerful thing about this is the vulnerability that the two of you are showing, right? Is that, you know, it's very often, especially around Bell Let's Talk Day, when I would do tons of interviews, be interviewed by people, it would be like the only ones that really were significant were ones that started with someone sharing something about their own life. You know, because everyone has a mental health story, right? Whether it's you or whether it's someone you care about. I mean, the whole Bell Let's Talk Day started because George Cope, who was then president and CEO, grew up with a mother who was in and out of mental hospitals, and they never spoke about it in their house. So it was like this taboo thing that he didn't understand. He didn't know why his mom was gone and why she came back and why people would be gentle around her. And he said, you know, I conversation would have changed my life. So, you know, when you do an interview like this and you're giving as much of yourself as you want the guest to give, that's to me when it gets really powerful.
I wonder what it was back then with like shunning people that did have mental health issues. If maybe just like the higher powers thought that they could just get away with it by forcing people to just push it all down and they could still function, you know, like, because you do read about like, even like I've dived into a little bit of research about like the psychedelic stuff and that whole movement and just like, and shunning that away, even though it did have some positive effects to help people with things like PTSD and bipolar, those type of things. So I wonder what, like, if it's just like kind of just the same attitude we have now, is just like, kind of don't talk about it, move on, and you'll forget about it and still be able to function and contribute in some sort of way, but not the most healthy way, I guess.
Yeah, it's so complicated too, because I said it before, you know, you can't explain the pain of mental illness to people. As a result, it's impossible to relate to it unless you've been through it. That's why it's so difficult to be a caregiver, you know, someone who wants to provide comfort to, you know, whether it's your partner in life or whether it's a son or daughter or any person that you care about. If you haven't been through, you can't understand what they're going through. So their illness sometimes can be looked at as inconvenient. You know, you're the boss and, you know, you have 20 people that work for you and one of them is struggling with depression. Well, them needing to take time off or other allowances is really inconvenient for the boss. So yeah, it's easier to minimize it than it is a physical illness, which can be defined. I got a tumor. You know, it's like no one's going to say, okay, well, you know what, just, you know, kind of deal with it.
Another thing that comes to my mind when you say that too is like, it can be frustrating if you're on the other, if you're, say your significant other has some mental health problems, like as the supporter, like it can be frustrating because you can't just snap your fingers and fix it, right? Like it does, it's a process and it does take effort to be supportive through that whole process when, like you said, like it might be hard to understand and it's hard to, for your significant other to explain themselves too. So that's probably an issue as well.
Right. I think the key is to say the words, hey, I thought I understood, but I don't. Mm-hmm. Because we assume, because there's no physical sign of mental illness, that somehow we understand it because somehow we've all been through it. Like people say all the time, oh, we all go through it sometime. And it's like, no, that pisses me off because, you know, we all go through bad times in our lives. You know, my dad died 14 months ago, and that makes me sad, but it doesn't make me depressed. We all go through sadness. It's an inevitability in life, right? Like, how are you going to go through your life without, you know, losing people you care about? Of, you know, experiencing failure and loss and all of that. But we're not all mentally ill, so the two need to be separated. You know, we all get anxious when we go to the doctor and the doctor says, you know, I don't like the way this feels. I'm gonna send you for a biopsy. Like for 3 weeks, you're freaking out, right? But that's not anxiety disorder. That's, you know, life. So I think we all believe to some extent we've been through depression and anxiety. Which are obviously the most common mental health challenges. And we think to ourselves, we've been through it and we've beaten it because we didn't have to go on medication. We didn't have to take time off work. We didn't have to go to talk to a counselor. And I think that that arrogance of the healthy brain makes it difficult, even more difficult to understand what that person that sleeps beside you may be going through. So I think the first thing you do in that situation is to say, hey, I thought I understood it. I don't. But you can't understand anything that you haven't been through. Like, could you go into, imagine if I came in, did you do AA?
No.
Okay. My point was only, was not to ask you that question because I think it's necessarily, like I'm not judging you on it. But imagine if I went into a 12-step meeting and got up in front of people and said, hey, I understand what you're all going through. Wow, this is, you know, and they said, well, you know, like, what was your addiction? And I said, well, no, I was never addicted. I just know it must be really shitty. They go, well, you don't understand this. You know, if I walked into 12 people having chemotherapy and said to them, hey, guys, you know what? Wow, this is terrible, I'm sure. And wow, I really feel for you. I know how bad it is. Oh, what kind of cancer did you have? Well, I don't have cancer. I just know it's bad, right? No one would say that. That would be absurd to say. But we say that when it comes to mental illness. Oh, I know what you're going through. No, you don't know what I'm going through. And the fact that you say that you know it, even though you don't, makes this more difficult for me.
Yeah, that I've never thought about it like that. Like that awareness and that acknowledgement is so important.
So important. Just, all you have to say is, you know, sorry I pissed you off so many times by suggesting you go for a nice walk. Right. But it's because I love you. Right. Like, you know, this kindness and doing nice things for people is a great thing. But don't expect it to treat the illness because the illness is far deeper than, wow, you know, I needed to get some sunshine.
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, Michael, I think we could both chat for hours on end. But once again, you said it perfectly so many times, you know, just the fact that we're doing this. I think that's the main thing. And I know we have so much appreciation and love for what you're doing with the Lands Blogs, with the Sick Not Weak. So please, you know, keep doing it because it's, I know it's impacting and it's relatable and it's natural and that's what it's all about. So thank you so much for joining us today, for, you know, letting us in a little bit about the Landsberg story. And I know it's, you know, it's never the easiest thing to maybe talk about on at 11 a.m. on a Sunday morning, but you know what?
Actually, it was, it's easy for me to talk about any day I feel good. It's like, there's two versions of me, right? Bad day, I'd be thinking, God, why did I say I would do this? I'm just going to let these guys down. Even though I don't know you, you would say, well, like, you know, do you really care that much? And the answer is, I don't care at all what people think of me when I feel good. But when I don't feel good, then it's like, oh my God. And I know this now sounds like the gratuitous end of the interview conversation where everyone compliments each other. And I'm better at giving compliments than taking them. Yeah. So I'll say this, you guys are amazing. I learned stuff in this and I learned from listening to you, the power of vulnerability. So, anytime.
Hey, one last question. Who's getting the last spot in the East NHL?
You know, I don't care because, my Maple Leafs are, did you see last night that they put in the, I don't know, like the neutral goalie, right? Who can play for either team. They put him in with 1 minute to go. And Chris Weidman, they asked him to coach, and he was so disrespectful. He says, yeah, well, they'll get theirs in, you know, in 2 weeks or whatever, meaning like they'll get knocked out. And I thought, You know, I'm pumped. Like, I was brought up on the Leafs and the Argos and the Blue Jays and then the Raptors eventually. But, you know, I don't think we choose the teams we love. I think it's in our blood. And, you know, it'd be easier if we could. Like, if I could say, you know, I think I'll be a Tampa Bay Lightning fan if this was like 5 years ago. You can't do that. So go Leafs, go. Who's your team?
Ben, grew up a Leafs fan during the Sundin era. So.
Matt Sundin, lovely soul. I because we were doing off the record then, I could tell you stories about all those guys, but we'll save that for another time.
I'll have to do this one again, Ty.
Well, 100%. Yeah. Thank you so much again, Michael.
This episode is also brought to you by BioSteel. Zero sugar, essential electrolytes, great taste, and pure hydration. Join the likes of Connor McDavid, Alec Manoa, Andrew Wiggins, Brooke Henderson, and Patrick Mahomes on the BioSteel train. It's time for you to try BioSteel with our SYM25 discount code that will get you 25% off at checkout. Yep, that's right. I will gladly attest to this being the best hydration drink on the market. SYM25 at checkout.